Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices. Meanwhile, please enjoy this encore presentation of Real Vision content.
This is Aaron Chan of Macro Voices. For this week's Real Vision TV encore presentation, we're bringing you an interview, which was published on May 23rd, between Grant Williams of Real Vision TV and Simon Mikhailovich, co-founder of Tocqueville Bullion Reserve. Backed by his vast financial experience, Mr. Mikhailovich shares his boots-on-the-ground insights on the physical bullion markets and also discusses gold in the context of wealth confiscation by governments and cybercrime in the digital age. After a thorough exposition of the current global monetary climate, he definitively clears the air on how he expects gold to perform under inflationary or deflationary environments. Now, Eric and I know a lot of our listeners follow gold very closely, so we hope you enjoy this Real Vision TV encore presentation.
Simon, good to have you back.
Thank you.
Always so much to talk about, and you and I have chatted over recent weeks about a bunch of stuff, so I think it was a great chance to get you back. And the first thing I want to talk to you about is you've just got back from a trip to Europe and some thoughts you had on what's going on in the gold market there. So tell us a little bit about the trip and what you found out.
Sure. Just got back 2 nights ago. Went to see some investors, potential investors, and audit the gold, which we'll talk about a little later, TBR gold. And also met with a couple of refiners, basically two largest refiners in Switzerland, to get some market color to understand what the flows are like. And actually, when you and I sat down in January, I said that, which was true at the time, that there are sporadic shortages, that some refineries are running quite behind on their schedule. And what I heard this time is the opposite of that. In fact, they're all pretty, they're trading people. They're in the business of moving metal back and forth. So they were pretty morose. I mean, they're saying that the demand has fallen off after the February surge, that in fact some people are divesting, meaning they're seeing flows coming back to them. They are seeing some selling from China, interestingly enough.
Yeah, that is interesting.
They also are seeing, although in scale it's not material either way, but just it's interesting in terms of direction, is that we've discussed before that for the past 3 or 4 years, gold has been coming out, the 400-ounce bars have been coming out of the London bullion market and going back to Switzerland, going to Switzerland to be refined into kilo bars and going to Asia. And actually, because of these reverse flows, they're saying that actually a few of the bars are making their way back to London. But the most interesting thing, I think, strategically, so this is a tactical discussion as to what's going on. What it means to me is that what happened in the past 3 months started out maybe as a rush for safe haven, but with the central banks stepping in again and doing whatever they, whatever it takes and floating the markets back up for the moment, it's turned into a safe haven trade, which is to say that the most of the action is taking place in the paper market rather than in the physical market. But what's more interesting strategically is that both refiners said that the banks are pulling back from the business, bullion banks. Barclays is gone, Deutsche is gone, meaning no longer have the commodity business. Mitsui is gone. There's a bit of a glut of storage space because Barclays Vault and Deutsche Vault has been sold. Interestingly, Chinese bought up the vault. So to sum up, what it sounded like to me is that on a tactical short-term basis, I don't know whether this run-up is not going to pull back a little bit. that depending on the Western investors in terms of real desire to cover systemic risk by buying physical gold is still not there quite.
Yeah.
However, what it also means is that when banks pulling out, or some of the bullion banks are pulling out, and the banks that are not pulling out, I was told, are reducing lines, you know, trading lines, that speculative trading of physical gold is becoming more complicated, and that cash market is becoming more important. And so if, an, or not if, but when, rather, Western investors finally get the message, and we will talk about what's going on in there, I think the original thesis remains in place. There is a pretty tight supply. It's not as tight as it was, 2 months ago, but relative to the types of flows that we see into high yield bonds or into, mm-hmm. The normal financial products, this is pittance. So nothing strategically has changed. It's we're watching the next attempt by central banks to stabilize the situation, which I believe will fail. But for the next, few weeks, months or whatever, this is kind of where we are. That's what I learned from
that. I guess we'll see if we do get a pullback in the price, which, again, I've honestly been waiting for since about $1,250. I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet, but I think we'll get one. It'll be interesting at that point to see, do we get a rush back into physical for all those guys who wanted some, a bit worried, feel like it's run too far, and then they see it correct, $50, $75, whatever it might be, $100, who knows. If at that point the refiners start to see a big surge in demand, that tells me that we do have something here that's built on a much more solid foundation.
Look, I think I've said that before in these interviews. Until a certain amount of investors, Western investors, finally understand the depth of the predicament that this financial system is in. And as we will talk, you and I will discuss a little later, some of the fairly credible establishment voices are all of a sudden starting to talk about gold. When that happens, that's when you're going to see the real run for the roses. Otherwise, it's all sort of speculative, back and forth, like with all the normal markets, ebbs and flows. But I do have to say that when in February, when the start price, when the price started going up, people started chasing.
Yeah.
People sit and they don't want to do anything, and then they're afraid to miss the opportunity. And that, in part, what drives these spurts. But in the end, gold is the opposite of confidence. And as long as the confidence in the financial system, whether it's hanging by a thread or however it's hanging, remains hanging, you will continue to see these normal market ebbs and flows. Once the confidence gets shaken in a real way, that's when all bets are going to be off.
Well, this confidence idea is, I've banged on about this for such a long time now, and around the edges, it's starting to feel to me as if I'm seeing more and more articles talking about a loss of confidence in central banks, which that's the bell that I wanted to hear ring, that the fact that people are talking about that now. Because from there, confidence is such a fragile thing. And so the move from people just kind of throwing the idea out there that maybe there's a loss of confidence to it going happens really fast when it happens.
You're absolutely right. But what's important to understand, think in terms of like bankruptcy process in general. It has a lot to do with confidence. Right, the trigger to bankruptcy, to actual filing, is usually loss of confidence by the lenders in the ability of the borrower to repay. Poor people and non-creditworthy entities go bust immediately.
Yeah, right.
Because the reserve, the depth of the reserve of confidence is very shallow, and it's very easy to lose that confidence. The wealthy, long-established families, go bust very, very slowly until, like Hemingway said, until all at once, right. And I think that, and the reason for that is clear, because they have built a fairly deep pool of confidence through history, through past performance, through the reputation of the families or whatever it is. And the same thing with the Western economies. These economies have been the pillars of the global economic engine, if you will, or the global economic infrastructure for years. And so people naturally feel fairly comfortable that whatever they've known for all these years is going to continue for the next however many years. And yes, the confidence is fraying, but the reason it's taking so long is because the pool, the depth of the pool of credibility that has been built has been so deep. Now, as our outgoing president likes to say, make no mistake, this is between the central bankers and the fiscal authorities. They have been wasting no time working 24/7 to deplete that pool of confidence. Right. But they have a lot of work to do because the pool is so deep. But you're right. I think we're getting there. And I believe that the breaking point is going to come with the next recession. That's going to be when we legitimately see a slowdown where a number of companies are just not going to be in a position to meet their obligations. That's when the confidence in the overall system is going to come into question. So the other thing I wanted to touch on about the conversations with refiners and some of the investors that I met is that the compliance regime keeps tightening. It really keeps tightening. Essentially, what we're witnessing, and again, we're in a minute when we start talking about some of the recent developments in cybercrime and similar situations, there is really, starting with the U.S., but now spreading around the world, sort of criminalization almost of assets that are not kept inside regulated financial institutions. You're presumed to be guilty rather than innocent if you you know, if your money is not in a conventional bank account. And frankly, often you're now presumed to be guilty even if you're just trying to withdraw your own money from a bank.
Yeah.
You have to explain yourself. I mean, this is a pretty unusual situation, I would say. Certainly nothing that we have seen in the Western world or in democracies. Well, I don't know, I wasn't around during World War II or during the Great Depression, but certainly nothing we have seen post-World War II. And the way it bears on what I do at Tocqueville Bullion Reserve and what people do in terms of gold investing is it really creates a whole different dimension of needing to understand the exit strategies. Because it's easy to buy gold. I mean, there are plenty of people that will sell you gold, and they will stash it for you in different places. But the format in which you do that may have a lot to do with your ability to monetize it. Because the idea of why you want to own it is to mobilize it as a resource at the moment when you need it. And so if all of a sudden, you know, the way you executed that strategy, when you try to get out, you're perceived as a money launderer or a terrorist financier, it's not only is it not going to help, I mean, it potentially can cause tremendous problems for you.
The perfect recent example of that, obviously, is the Panama Papers. And when you look at the coverage of a lot of people doing something that's completely legal, I mean, it's extraordinary. There was an article in the Daily Telegraph in the UK, which is a reputable newspaper, and they had a list of celebrities whose names were revealed by the Fonseca Papers. And it started off with Simon Cowell, who's obviously one of Britain's richest men, and it talks about he had a company in Panama that was he used to buy some land, all perfectly legal. And it said underneath him, Mr. Cowell has done nothing illegal, or there's no suggestion of illegality in this. It then listed about 15 or 20 more well-known people. Some were showbiz, sports stars, borderline royal family, that kind of stuff. And it went through what had been laid out. And at the bottom of the article, in a sentence that wasn't even a standalone sentence, it ran along from the last sentence, it said, there's no suggestion of illegality in any of these things. It was, you almost had to try and find this. The inference was clear. These are all shifty people doing shifty things. And that atmosphere of persecution, of people acting within the law in their own best interests, to me is incredibly worrying.
Listen, this is criminalization of wealth at some level. I mean, you're mentioning these names. How about David Cameron?
Right.
The Prime Minister of the United Kingdom had to stand up in Parliament and explain himself.
Yeah.
And what has he done? Now, I don't know the exact details, but from what I've heard, what he did is his father had been an asset manager, a money manager, and his father ran a hedge fund, which is called unit trust.
Yep.
In Europe, right? So he ran a unit trust that was domiciled in Panama. And David Cameron, as a son invested in his father's hedge fund.
Yeah.
I mean, what's and then paid the taxes after he sold the interest.
Correct.
So why is he standing explaining himself in front of the parliament of the United Kingdom? I mean, so the character assassination and the innuendo that's imputed into this development is extremely, extremely worrying. And that's when I say that the you know, in talking to refiners, they're saying that they're getting calls from even very wealthy people who want to buy gold and they cannot sell it to them because they don't want to take the risk of the anti-money laundering laws and the know your customer rules. And you know, I don't want to go into that, but I, but what I have to go through, what TBR has to go through, to prove the credentials to open accounts, to be able to trade at wholesale prices with some of these entities. I mean, you know, 10, 15 years ago, this would have been considered a, you know, examination with extreme prejudice.
Right.
But, you know, Spanish boot.
Right.
In a financial sense. But that's what we have to do it. But that's what creates value that we could, you know, deliver to other people. And that's what you have to do in order to be in this business.
But I guess that, I mean, that's a big part of it. If you don't have your, if you have your account open, when the shutters come down, most of the time you're okay, right? It's trying to get these accounts open when it's too late.
I asked this guy straight up, how long does it take to open an account? How many people do you deal with? And they basically said, look, it's a process. We have a whole board committee that approves every account. And certainly there will be no new business if and when things get hairy. I mean, there's no question about that. So I think that I cannot overemphasize for everybody who's listening out there that they need to really, really understand the war on cash, the fact that 500 euro bill is getting scrapped. You know, that was announced yesterday, I think, in the papers. This is all part of the same dynamic. It's the war on cash. It's the war. It's the war on all assets that are not cataloged, reported, and controlled by the regulated financial system. There's nothing illegal about having money, having made money and paid taxes. There's nothing illegal. There should be nothing illegal. Shouldn't be anything illegal about holding your money however you want to hold it. But clearly these are new facts. And, you know, when things change, you got to change your opinion. You have to change your strategy. There's another aspect to Panama Papers beyond that, and that's the digitization of wealth. Mm-hmm. I did a little numbers. If people want to go to our website, www.bullionreserve.com, I wrote a little note about that, and I did some sort of back-of-the-envelope calculations. First of all, this is by the factor of 10, the largest cyber theft in history. It's the largest document theft in history. And I will demonstrate to you in 1 second why that is. 11.5 million documents, apparently, purloined. If we assume very conservatively that every document is on average 3 pages long.
Okay. That's conservative.
That's pretty conservative. I'm sure it's much more than that. So that would give us 33 some million pages. Now nobody has any concept of what that is. So I took pen to paper and I figured out what that is. So what 33.5 million pages represents is copy paper that would weigh as much as 2 737 aircraft. If the old-fashioned way, James Bond way, if somebody was there micro-photographing, you know, every page, right? It would take 12.5 man years to photograph all of these pages. So it'll take 12.5 man years to photograph. It would take 60,000, I think, pallets. It's on the website. 60,000 pallets of print, you know, the standard, you know, things that everybody has in their supply closet in their office, pallets of paper, and they would weigh as either 35, 36 automobiles or full takeoff weight of 2 737 Boeing jets. Clearly, it was impossible to have ever done anything like this.
Yeah.
This is not something, it's like conventional weapons versus you know, some other weapons. There was no way in history to ever steal that much paper. Just physically impossible.
Right.
Just can't be done. So something that was impossible has been rendered possible through digitization of documents and digitization of also wealth. And corollary to that, we just talked about, there was an article, I have a paper here somewhere, not too many headlines, but I picked this up in Europe. It says, online heist exposes risks of banks, you know, of banking in the global system. And what this article talks about is that the way, by the way, what I'm referring to here is that several weeks ago, yet unknown cyber thieves have penetrated the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. I was downtown yesterday and I just took a look at that building. There's also a note on the website and you can go take a look, and there's a picture of the building. I mean, that is a fortress that cannot be stormed. So 80 million, at first it was believed to have been 100 million. Now it's they've boiled it down to only $80 million. Okay. Only $80 million. So $80 million has been stolen through SWIFT, which is a central money transfer system that connects all the banks in the world. So the gist of this article is essentially saying that globalization of the financial transfers and the fact that all of the financial transfers flow through one hub, which is the SWIFT system, has made the system as vulnerable as the weakest link. And it turns out that the weak link was in Bangladesh. What really is stunning here is that this headline comes several weeks after the theft. There were a couple of headlines before that. Now, can you imagine for a minute what kind of press and what kind of scandal would there have been had an Ocean 11 type operation was conducted against the fortress that is Federal Reserve Bank of New York? If actually armed robbers went into that building and walked away and escaped with $81 million and still uncaught, what kind of story would that have been?
We've seen this recently in the UK with this bunch of geriatric thieves who drilled a hole into a wall and stole gold. It was on every front page for weeks.
That's right.
It was a huge story. I remember reading about this, I guess it must have been a month ago now. It certainly feels like that. And I was amazed. It didn't really appear in the press anywhere. People don't understand what a new bank robbery looks like versus an old bank robbery.
Not only that, but this article makes a point that this is actually happening. There's a big move going on from the little theft where people, you know, we're all familiar with identity theft. We all know that sometimes a credit card gets pilfered, taken over, and, you know, unauthorized charges. Well, apparently this is moving. And in fact, they made the reference to the Ocean's 11 type operations. This cyber theft is moving into big time. And as Jim Rickards makes a point in his new book, I mean, not only is cyber theft moving into big time, but cyber war is moving into big time. And the fact that both the Chinese and the Russians and the United States maintain significant cyber forces whose job potentially it is to disrupt all kinds of operations, including financial operations, of the opposing side, I mean, creates completely new risks to money. And also it creates a complete new case for owning gold, which, you know, just, you know, look, I'm in the business, so I last time I was here, I brought a bar of gold. I understand the physicality of gold, but I don't go every day into the warehouse where we store our gold. So on this trip, I usually do an audit. We do three audits a year. You know, twice by independent auditors, different independent auditors, and once I do it for the for internal controls, because I'm a large investor of my in TBR. I want to know it's there.
Sure.
Right, I want to touch it myself. And, you know, in the past two or three years, it's something that takes an hour. You go in and you have a list and you just compare the bars, you check everything off. Everything's there. Well, we've fortunately been growing and getting more bars. We've also switched maybe a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, switched from buying 400 ounce LBMA bars, 12 and a half kilo bars, which are $500,000 a piece, to kilo bars, which are more of a liquid standard in Asia. Mm-hmm. And I think for individuals, because we allow physical withdrawals, you know, who's walking away with the 12 and a half kilo, but which is 26 pound bar. So we switched to kilo bar. So more bars, more CUSIP numbers, more boxes. So I show up and I think this is all going to take an hour. I'm very, you know, fortunately I was casually dressed. You know, all these people with guns there. They give me the inventory list, and we start, you know, we open the pallets. They bring the pallets by the forklift. We open all these pallets. The stash is getting bigger, which is nice. I immediately realize that the inventory I have is chronological, so it doesn't help looking for the bars versus the list. Oh, not a worry. So they go into the corner. There's a computer. They resort the inventory list, produce within 2 minutes, produce a very conveniently sorted list. We start the inventory, and 10 minutes in, it hits me. All right, so it's easy to check whether the bars are there by picking up a bar and finding it on a well-sorted digital list. What about the other way? What about when I want, when one of our partners wants to sell, and the way we manage the tax efficiency is that we track all the bars by whose money was used to purchase the bars, so that the cost basis of the bars and the cost basis of the investors match. So if somebody wants to sell, we would sell the bar that was purchased with his money, and then we would allocate the gain or loss to that investor so that other investors... Well, that creates a very, you know, this goes back to the physicality of the whole thing. So it turns out what we needed really is a... Now that we've getting bigger, you know, bigger, we need a library-like system. It's one thing when you have a library of 20 books. It's the other thing when you have a library of thousands of books. Then, you know, you need some system where it's in the row A, shelf B, whatever. So what I thought was going to be a 45-minute exercise was a sweaty, grimy, 3.5-hour project for four grown men. Moving around 55-pound boxes of 25 kilo bars in each, to organize them in a way that we can now easily pick up what whenever we want a bar, you know, it's a box number this, on a pallet number that. The reason I'm telling you this story is because it really brings home, in light of all this digitization and the cyber theft, you just can't. This is just heavy lifting. I mean, never mind stealing it. I mean, counting it is heavy lifting. This is not something some evil genius out of Bangladesh or Romania sitting in his underwear in his basement with a hyper-encrypted laptop can ever steal from you. I mean, people need to show up with heavy axle trucks and heavy artillery to break through through the real forces. So that just really brings home this whole idea that financialization and digitization have created the types of risks that people do not fully feel in the gut because we've become used to this. But the risks are real, and the robberies are starting to happen on a real scale. And the vulnerability in case of some kind of a military conflict are increasing very highly. So owning your wealth in digital form not only poses various kinds of systemic risks in terms of what you and I have been talking about, you know, leverage and bank failure and capital controls, but also literally potentially losing the record, the digital records. And of course, it's one thing to lose the digital records of what you own. It's the other thing when stocks themselves are digital. So not only do you use the record of ownership, you lose the security itself. Then you have layers of reconstruction to do. And that poses the risk. And I think that's where gold makes, and other non-digital assets make a lot of sense.
I want to go back to something you touched on at the beginning of this that I've had buzzing around my head and making sure I don't forget to talk to you about it. Establishment voices talking about gold. And it's I watch this stuff really closely, and it's very obvious to me that there's been a shift recently. We've had Stan Druckenmiller coming out this week very pointedly talking about his biggest currency position. We've had all sorts of other mainstream people talking about gold. Ken Rogoff, we've had a piece from PIMCO that got forwarded to me. I must have had that thing 50 times sent across my desk. Something's happening. What do you make of that shift?
I don't remember what the saying is, that people lose their mind in crowds and then they come back to their senses one at a time or something like that. I think this is huge. The reason this is huge is not because any of these people are right with the ideas that they're putting forth. And I want to talk about the ideas actually they're putting forth because they tie into the whole the war on cash, the compliance, the digital nature. The thing that we did that you and I haven't talked about this time, and that is the fact that and that's the Rogoff's point, sort of, that essentially central banks are trapped by the math. Mm-hmm. And the math that they're trapped by is very simple. They can't afford for the rates to go up because there's too much debt, and the ability to service that debt at higher rates is non-existent. That's one problem. The other problem, as you and I have discussed before, is the present value formula. When discount rate goes up, the value goes down, and the quantum of change is such where, yeah, for when you go from 2% to 6%, I mean, you can lose 75% of value just through mathematical, you know, recalculation of present value formula. So that's one problem. But the other problem is they can't really stay this low either because the pension fund industry is dying. I mean, literally dying.
Yeah.
I mean, we just saw the Teamsters Pension Fund applying to reduce benefits. And I don't know if people know that, but in 2014, there was a law, or there's a provision slipped into one of the funding bills that allowed the pension funds, which they were not, I mean, think about it. You contribute money to a pension your whole life, right? And then, there's a contract that if you pay contributions, then when you're older, they will give you the pension that they promised you. So in 2014, something was slipped into a funding bill that allowed pension funds to petition the court if they can show legitimately calculations that if they continue payouts, I think it's for 10 years, they will be bankrupt, or maybe 10 to 20 years, but I think it's 10 years. If they can demonstrate that they will not be able to continue to make promised payments beyond 10 years, the court may allow them to change the benefits. And that's what's going on right now. So the pressure on the Fed and other central banks is growing very quickly because the pension fund industry and the insurance industry, which also relies on fixed income, you know, are and who have liabilities that need to be met over many years. And in order to meet these liabilities, they need returns, which they're not getting. I mean, so we're having a complicated situation on all fronts. And I think that situation is starting to sink in. It started to sink in with other people earlier. For example, the first voice that I heard, very, very insider official voice, was Robert Zoellick, who was the head of the World Bank, and before that was the U.S. Trade Representative. He came out and said something about gold standard, which at the time was just received as a little bit preposterous. We then saw Alan Greenspan, as soon as he left his position as the Fed chairman, essentially being in charge of debauching the currency and became a private citizen, started writing about gold and the importance of gold and why the central banks hold gold. We have Mervyn King, who just came out with a book, which I have not yet read. We talked about that. Which apparently is extremely critical about the policies of central banks and the perdition that these policies are leading us into. And then in the past 2 weeks, 3 weeks, we have a piece from PIMCO that refers to the Grimm's fairy tale Rumpelstiltskin. For those who don't remember, it's about it's a story where somebody was able to spin straw into gold. And admittedly provocatively, this piece on PIMCO stationery, for those who, I'm sure everybody knows who PIMCO is, but maybe not everybody knows that PIMCO is owned by a German insurance company, Allianz, and is, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure it's the largest asset manager in the world. And if it's not the largest asset manager in the world, it's the largest bond manager in the world, by far. So for a firm like that, even as a provocative piece by its economist, to publish a paper that not jokingly suggests that maybe the Fed should open the window to buy gold at $5,000 an ounce to create inflation. And the basis for that argument is that's what Roosevelt administration did in 1934, devalued the dollar by revaluing gold. That's huge. I mean, that is huge because, I mean, okay, zero hedge. And, you know, Paul Brodsky and me and, you know, Jim Rickards. And I mean, there are a bunch of people, Dan Hunt, you know, I mean, there are a bunch of people that have been talking about things like that for a number of years. But when the largest asset manager management company that manages money for everybody starts talking like that, I mean, there's clearly some sinking in that's going on. Now, the Rogoff piece, which and let's, for those who don't know who Ken Rogoff is, it's important to know. Because Ken Rogoff is the person who wrote the book with Carmen Reinhart about the, This time is different, about the consequences of too much debt. He is the person, he is the ultimate establishment insider. He is a Harvard professor. He was a chief economist of the IMF for a couple of years. He is clearly in the epicenter of the central bank thinking about various, about what's going on. And so here's a man who comes out and says, in so many words, that he thinks that the, by the way, he's also the man who came out with an article proposing abolition of cash. And his argument for that was that because of the negative interest rates, there's no way to enforce the negative interest rates until all the cash is taken hostage. And in order to take the cash hostage, we have to digitize it so that it can be all brought into the financial system and eliminate people's ability to essentially escape. And then we can we can do to them what we want to do to them. Now, in fairness to him, that was an intellectually honest piece, because that's what, given the existential crisis that this financial system is in, maybe does make doesn't make sense for investors.
No.
Right, but that probably makes sense for the governments.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, here he comes out and says, and I encourage everybody to read this piece because it's very, very telling. And what he says was, first of all, he acknowledges that gold is one of the most liquid and safest assets. And he cites a study, which there's a link in that article to the study, which I looked at, which shows that for the last 100-some years, real returns on gold have actually been slightly better than short-term treasuries, including all the volatility. So if gold, over a long period of time, is as safe to hold and is as liquid as short-term treasury securities, and certainly as cash, well, there's a legitimate reason for certain people to hold it. Now, who are the people that he recommends hold it? He does not recommend it for the Western governments, because clearly he's intellectually honest that the Western governments need to grab everybody's money and debase it. And he suggests the method for doing that. Now, he says in this article that just because for the Western economies, gold is not at the moment helpful or necessary because of what's going on, that doesn't mean that that applies to the emerging economies. And he suggests that emerging countries should significantly increase the portion of their reserves that are held in U.S. currency and in U.S. treasuries in gold. Okay, you can take that at face, you know, you can basically say this is ridiculous, or you can say it's never going to happen. You can say whatever you want to say. But the fact that a legitimate person, and by the way, when he suggests the cancellation of cash, you know, and now, as I just said earlier, you know, so there goes the 500 euro note.
Right.
So when the guy says something, it's not totally out of it. He's not totally out of it. So now he says this. The annual production of, just put in context what we're talking about, China has $3 trillion of reserves, right? China claims it has only 2% of its reserves in gold. I mean, we think it's more, but okay, so maybe they're off by, I don't know, maybe it's 6% or 7%. But you're talking about $3 trillion. So all of the emerging market economies have trillions and trillions of dollars. This man is talking about 10% or more into physical gold. The annual production of gold, I don't remember the exact number, but it's something like $120, $110 billion a year. That's all the gold that's mined every year. I mean, if these countries decide to follow, even to some extent, this is before the Western investors lose their confidence. This is just a whole different, this is a whole different source of demand, right? Gold price would reprice completely.
I'm sure there are a bunch of emerging market central bankers who woke up in the morning, read that article, and just went, oh, damn it, because we know what Russia's doing, we know what China's doing, we know what the Philippines and Turkey, we know all these guys are steadily increasing their gold reserves, some faster than others. The last thing they want is that little game to get out in the open, because at the moment they've been able to accumulate it pretty successfully.
His point is not enough.
Right.
And the reason, by the way, what the interesting thing is, one of the reasons he gives for why he thinks this makes a lot of sense is because he admits that the whole game with treasuries has reached its logical conclusion. Treasuries cannot appreciate anymore, and gold can. So the point that he makes is, whereas treasuries are in unlimited supply but have no room to appreciate because the rate is zero, gold is in limited supply, but that's not a problem because the price can appreciate dramatically.
See, no, this is fascinating because...
What's not to love?
No, but this is something, you know, I've heard you say, I've said it myself, that I could pull 20 names out of my head who've all said the same thing. And yet, it's only when someone like Ken Rogoff says it that it suddenly starts to become, oh, wow, he's smart, that guy. Like, he's not some wacko like Williams or Mikhailovich or these other guys, right? He's a smart guy. But that's all it takes, right? It's the right guy saying the same thing, and it has a sea change effect on what's going on.
Look, I'm an investor. I don't have the ambition to be recognized as an intellectual father of anything.
Right.
I just want to be right in the end, and I want my partners to profit and to benefit from me being right in the end. And the fact that I've been saying it for years, but now people who matter say right. it, and if that leads to the result that I have positioned for and I've positioned my partners for, then it's okay with me. I mean, it's fine. I don't need to have a movie made about me. That's perfectly fine. And I think it's happening. I think we're getting there.
Well, look, we need to wrap this up, but there's one thing I can't let you go without asking you, and that's that in your last interview there was some questions posted in the comments section. Things I've got you here,
right?
That mostly seem to be around inflation and deflation. I know you read the comments because we've
sure, chatted. Sure.
Perhaps you could just run through them and then answer.
Yeah, the question that was asked is for me to explain how gold, or what I think about gold in terms of inflation and deflation. I think this is a tremendously misunderstood subject, because it's impossible. You know, in philosophy, there's a concept that before you can discuss a matter, it's a Greek saying. I don't remember exactly how the Greek saying goes, but it's impossible to discuss a matter unless you agree on the definitions of what it is you're talking mm-hmm. about. And a good friend actually just brought this to my attention, who I saw in Europe, Tony Diedenup. Shout out to him, one of the smartest investors I know. Anyway, so what is inflation? What is deflation? People think in terms of 1930s. People think in terms of inflation is a term of art. And deflation is a term of art, and they supposedly mean certain things. So the first thing I think it's important to understand, the historical precedent for the type of situation we're dealing with now is, I think, World War I. In the military sense, the governments and the general staffs of the combatants, who ended up being combatants, were laying out their war plans based on the 19th century military technology. Even though the new technology already existed, but it hasn't yet percolated into the minds of the planners what the implications of those technologies were. And so when the war started, the idea was that the cavalry was going to lead the charge. Now, I have to say, it's not a Polish joke, but you know, the Polish army attempted to confront the German Panzer divisions in 1939 with light cavalry. It didn't work very well. And so, but in 1914, clearly, the war that was started had absolutely nothing to do with what every planner had in mind. It was basically like using sabers against chemical, nuclear weapons, aviation, tanks, and heavy artillery. I think we're in this situation with financial system. I think the technologies that created this ability to inflate the debt, credit derivatives, securitization, off-balance sheet banking, the fact that money is no longer money. You know, so when you talk about deflation, Deflation against what? I mean, money used to be backed by gold. So deflation is the falling prices against a constant that is money. And in that, and the, so the idea of people, which by the way is totally wrong, is that gold falls in price against money, which is a fixed, it's a fixed number. Money is not fixed to anything. There is no anchor. So the whole concept of deflation, which is the dropping prices relative to currency, is a preposterous notion. They will create as much currency as they want, which is exactly what they're doing. Inflation? Well, there's huge inflation in financial assets, in luxury goods, in all kinds of things. But the official measures of inflation are not picking it up. So I would say for those people who are trying to reconcile in their head how gold behaves in deflation versus inflation, I think it's a spurious line of thinking altogether. I think how you need to think about is the purchasing power of financial assets, whether it's dropping or whether it's rising, and what the gold's purchasing power does at the same time. And I also think you need to think in terms of permanent impairment versus no permanent impairment. Financial assets and currencies have a risk of permanent impairment. Whether that impairment comes through inflation or deflation doesn't matter. Essentially, destruction of purchasing power, destruction of the claim that you have on something, is impairment. Gold does not have the risk of impairment. So I think that gold in this round will perform both in inflation and deflation because it's an asset that's impervious to debasement either through inflation or through default. And that is how I think about that. It is the lack of permanent impairment, the lack of the risk of permanent impairment that is the defining feature of gold versus financial assets. And the other measures, it's sort of like those generals who were thinking they were going to storm with the sabers, against the Big Bertha guns. So I think this is basically where we are right now. The consciousness of the people, the consciousness of the financial, even most financial professionals, is not yet aligned. Even though they had a wake-up call in 2008, is not yet aligned with the realities of things like some guy from God knows where takes $81 million and walks away from a fortress downtown New York. No fuss, no muss, no blood spilled, nobody arrested. I mean, that's new. These are new facts. This is new reality. I think people need to understand. And the final thing I want to say in conclusion, which I think, I don't remember if I said it before in our interviews, but I truly think that people of my generation, baby boomer generation, are facing an financial existential crisis. And that is, we know there will be a crisis. I mean, there are crises every 7-8 years. I mean, the question is not whether there will be a crisis. The question is, what kind of crisis will it be? Whether or not it's as devastating as I think it will be, or whether it's not quite as devastating, the most important thing is those who do not protect their nest egg will have no chance to recover. I'm 57 years old. There's no way, if I lose everything I have, there's just no time for me to recoup the losses. I think that everybody owes it to themselves, to their families, to their children, to the people for whom they're responsible, to educate themselves and to really understand what it is that's going on and why is it different and how this difference can play out in real life. And so if I leave you with anything, it's that it is time for people to stand up and take responsibility for what they have earned, for what they have built, and not leave themselves and their loved ones dispossessed. Just don't be greedy. Don't worry about return on your capital. Worry about return of your capital. I think that's the time for that right now and not for the other one.
Simon, it's a sobering warning, but it's that kind of day outside. So look, as always, you know how much I love talking to you. Thanks again for coming back, and we'll do this again soon, I hope.
Absolutely. Pleasure.